Ryan Stanton here with AZEP Frontline. Today, a very special episode talking with Dr. Thomas Marshburn, and emergency physician, but also he's one of the a physician that has recently spent some time outside the traditional poles of our Earth's orbit, and wanted to chat with him, reach out recently on the International Space Station, and we reached out hoping we'd get him just because of an emergency physician doing incredible things and outside the typical bounds of our emergency departments. And graciously, he and NASA both agreed, and so he's here today joining us, and we appreciate it. So, Dr. Marshburn, thank you for joining us here on the front line. So, you know, you have a relatively traditional beginning of things. You kind of grew up in the part of the country where I grew up with North Carolina. I grew up on the other side of the mountains there in Tennessee. And, you know, everything kind of began as a traditional medical type career, but clearly some motivations and interest very early. So give us some background and discuss your progression in emergency medicine, into medicine, and then eventually into the space program.
Yeah, sure. So I started out with an interest in space, a couple of books that I read in elementary school that completely turned my life around, and I was going to go into art, but decided to go into mathematics and engineering and into physics. So I graduated from Davidson College in physics and went straight into engineering, graduate school at UVA, and that found out, you know, it's working in the engineering field just wasn't, while I found it fascinating and certainly challenging, it wasn't as fulfilling as I wanted it. So I went into medicine, and then ended up in the emergency physician program, training program in Toledo, Ohio. During that time, I you know how it is. I mean, medicine is so engrossing and just takes your whole brain your whole life, especially during residency, and I forgot about spaceflight. But then I found out that NASA was just starting a new program to train outside physicians to become NASA flight surgeons to work with their pilots and their astronauts, and that was back in 93. That was through the University of Texas in their medical branch. And it was a fellowship at the time, but that's changed into a residency. But I graduated from that program, worked as a flight surgeon with NASA for 10 years. During that time, became interested in becoming an astronaut and realizing, hey, maybe there's something I could do. So I applied several times, ended up in the astronaut office back in 2004.
So, and we'll get to the whole recent adventures in space, because you've definitely been the support flight surgeon as well as backup for a number of missions, but then most recently spending time on the International Space Station. And, you know, that the U.S. space program, of course, has evolved significantly. I very much grew up during the space shuttle era. And watching those, and now the transition to some the private-public interactions. And the space program in the 60s, especially in the 60s, was very much a national, United States, just that's how it's going to be, competing with the Russian space program and others. But over the last decades, we've seen this international cooperation, especially with the Russians, with the Soyuz projects. Talk to us, because you actually spent some time in this career in Russia working with the program there. Talk about this international interaction that you had when you were progressing into this astronaut role yourself.
Yeah, so we've had a relationship with Russia, the U.S. space program has, for 40 years now, starting with the Apollo-Soyuz program. So it's really kind of a brilliant thing, merging the two countries and their approach to space flight. Some of the problems are identical, how to get into space, that sort of thing. But we've solved these problems in different ways. And that's come out to be great. Once we've formed a partnership to work together to have a permanent habitation of space, and we've been up there, Americans and Russians, together since 2000, for almost 22 years now, we've been able to use each other's technologies to keep up there and to keep going. It's been from a technical standpoint and from a international relations standpoint with spaceflight, it's been great. I came on board as a flight surgeon supporting those few astronauts that flew to the Mir space station before we even had an ISS. So I was out in Star City. I learned Russian. I've probably spent, all told, with all of my training over there, maybe 4 years in this little enclave called Star City. It's in an abandoned Air Force base from the Cold War times that appeared on the maps in the 90s. That's where the cosmonauts train. That's where we train for space flight when we're going to fly to the ISS in order to learn the Russian part of the space station. So I spent a lot of time over there, trained in the Soyuz, trained to be essentially the pilot for the Soyuz, as well as someone who can live and work on board the Russian side, as well as the rest of the space station.
So we're going to bounce. We'll get into the adventures and experiences on the ISS, but you know, really with most of our audience being emergency physicians, and you know, we're seeing so much now outside of traditional roles in medicine, the reliance on emergency physicians because of the training and background and kind of broad spectrum expertise with everything acute care episodes. What about your background in emergency medicine? Did you feel positioned you for this role? And that message that you have for the emergency physicians that are considering careers that would not be considered the traditional pathway when you go through medicine and residency?
Yeah. So, I mean, I believe that emergency physicians know about every aspect of medicine, but only so far. There's certain areas in which we can thrive and do extremely well, getting deep into the details. But otherwise, we're not experts. We're oftentimes referring to the experts. Being an astronaut is very much the same way. We need to know the entire space station, how it works. But there are experts on the ground that help us get all that, everything done that we need to and to maintain the space station. So the mindset is very similar, particularly because space medicine is new, not knowing exactly what we're going to be faced with mostly, then that kind of one begins to think of an emergency physician in that regard too, because our knowledge base is so broad. And in particular, when we think about any kind of wilderness medicine, I wrote a chapter for Auerbach's book. When we think of that, we can think of space as the ultimate wilderness in a lot of ways. And so naturally, emergency physicians, I think, gravitate towards that as well.
Well, it's definitely the definition of the austere environment and really being dependent on what you've got with you. You really just don't get Amazon to drop you off something up there when you need it right off the bat.
Exactly.
Give us a breakdown. So you've had a couple of missions involving the International Space Station. Give us a little breakdown of that life. Well, you know, kind of that transition from you're now into the astronaut corps itself, that training, the backing up, seeing that, you know, you're second in line on these, a lot of these missions, and then actually getting up there and finally commanding the International Space Station. Kind of walk us through that in life on the ISS.
You come on board, everybody needs to train the same and be at the same level, if you will, on their understanding of space orbital mechanics, all the, we're electricians, we're plumbers, we're IT specialists, we're mechanics in many ways while we're up there. So we undergo a pretty intensive 2-year period of training. All astronauts do. I was in a class of 14. And then you become eligible for a space flight once you pass that. The training also includes a lot of team building, kind of understanding what your limits are physically and mentally. We put us out into these other austere environments. I did winter survival on the Continental Divide in February, other survival out in the Wind River Range, live in a habitat underwater, wintertime in Russia. So they like to put you through some difficult times physically, just to understand how you can build a team, what your limits are, what you can contribute to a team. So once you've gone through all that, you get assigned to a flight. I've actually had 3 flights. My first one was to the space station in 2009, and that was a short flight, 16 days, 3 spacewalks, helping to build the space station, and then I've done 2 long duration flights. Preparing for those flights takes, once you're assigned, you start training again for the specifics of your flight. For the space station, I've trained for about 1.5 to 2 years just to get ready for that. A lot of spacewalk training. There is some medical training, but as a physician, they allowed me to bypass a lot of that. But we always have 2 crew medical officers. I was naturally the one of the 2 when I was on board. Crew medical officer could be anyone that's an astronaut. And so they go through that training program just to be able to apply what essentially amounts to limited ALS and advanced first aid with some kind of nuance that's specific to space medicine. And so that's involved in the training as well.
Interestingly, I saw that you mentioned the underwater, and I think you spent 2 weeks as an aquanaut underwater for that program. That's the And that's so you spent 2 weeks there. You go into the space program to go up, and you end up down underwater for 2 weeks. That's quite the change. With
yeah, it was a little bit unusual. Came to join NASA, I had to learn Russian, learn the Russian language. So you never know what you're going to get.
Well, that's, and that is interesting, because I remember going, you know, when we've been to the various space training centers, and you know, so much of that training underwater to mimic the zero gravity type environment and working and kind of working through the tools and how that transitions over. And you also kind of hinted at the mentioning, because science has always been at the core of the NASA mission, of the space exploration, of not just getting somewhere, but, you know, learning from it, you know, exploring. And you kind of got that more and more now it's getting into that medical side. We're looking at potentials of how the zero gravity or the space environment may impact terrestrial medicine. So where do you see kind of the evolution and space travel impacting the future of some of the terrestrial medicine and our patients in our emergency departments that we see here on Terra Firma?
The thing that I find most fascinating, and I published a bit and did some research on using ultrasound in the ER, in the waiting room of the ER, using it in ways that are typically not thought of at all, because you wouldn't want to do that. You wouldn't want to diagnose a hip fracture trying to use an ultrasound machine in the ER, because you have an X-ray machine right there. But in places where that's not available, places in the world, what's wrong with trying to use find out what the extreme limits of the tools that you might have available to you and seeing what they can do? Certainly, standard of care would be, say, an MRI or an X-ray, but in standard of care doesn't apply in all cases. So can you take a smart and curious, motivated individual, train them for, say, 1 hour on a one of your standard handheld ultrasound machines, and have them do diagnoses and adequate ultrasounds on remotely guided? And the answer is yes, you can. So while that might not advocate for our standard practice for healthcare, it's nice to know that we really could do extremely well that in getting diagnostic imaging to places that otherwise wouldn't get it. And in a number of cases, that's been picked up around the world. I think the UN got a hold of some of the work that and others were doing at the Henry Ford Hospital, because they were really pushing as far as you could, and being recognized for that and how you can provide medical care for even more remote areas. And I think that's probably the biggest thing, not just the diagnostic imaging, but other areas of medicine, where pushing what we do have and what we know now to the limit to see what we could do if we really had to out in these extreme environments.
Well, I'm sure the payload, space, and weight physics considerations for a butterfly IQ is probably much more friendly to the mission than trying to haul an MRI machine up to the International Space Station, not to mention what would happen when you spin that magnet up. So, that's our ultrasound folks are super excited about the opportunities to, in fact, we on the motorsports side travel with ultrasound now because of that portability and filling in those gaps in austere environments where you may not have some of the traditional tools.
I do want to add that as we get further from the Earth, where even the limitations by the speed limit of light, that is communication, would mean that we're going to have to be operating autonomously when we go to Mars. Could be 45 minutes for a round trip voice communication. And so the question then is, if you've got 4 or 6 people on a crew, if you're going to have one, probably 2 physicians, what kind of physicians are they going to be? Are they going to be emergency surgeons, family practice, probably some kind of generalist like that? And if so, how are they going to train? Are they going to train in medicine mostly? Because it might be 2 years before they ever have to use those skills again, because a mission could easily last 3 years. So those kinds of things, NASA's still trying to figure that out. And so I don't know what kind of terrestrial benefits that would have, but it's certainly an interesting question.
Well, and that's it, is really looking at kind of that long-term management and working with what you've gotten. And actually, that's a perfect segue to the next question. With the space program evolving from those initial leaps in the 60s, we talked about some of that initially U.S.-driven space missions, now with the international cooperation. How does that evolution in working at some of these future goals, getting back to the moon, heading to Mars, which is, on folks' radars and a push to just really conquer significant hurdles in terms of things that we've never done in the past. How does this evolution impact that future of missions and potential impact on worldwide science and technology as we prepare for these greater and longer missions and and eventually ending up on an alien planet?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing that we can say our experience to date has provided for NASA is, number one, humans do really well in zero G. In our 20 years of people living on board the space station, we haven't had a critical episode that required a deorbit yet. So that's a good thing. Having said that, we're still finding out things that happen to the human body that could result in a problem. We've had, you may have heard of SANS, which is an eye problem that it originally appeared to be older male astronauts. Maybe it's not just that, where you get retinal changes that affect your eyesight and that could lead to a permanent visual disability. So we're still trying to figure that out. Clotting in space, it turns out, may very well be, maybe spaceflight is part of the Virchow's triad, who knows? But it appears to be that in our vascular studies of astronauts, that clots form more often. So the more time spent in space, the more we find out about things that happen to humans. So spending all this time up there and watching what humans do is really fascinating and really essential, so we can be prepared to go away for 3 years with no hope of turning back and no hope of getting resupplied. So that's been an incredibly fascinating thing. The physiology of the human body in zero G, not to mention the high radiation environment, still not completely well understood, but is certainly fascinating. It's a brand new world, as far as we can tell, impossible to recreate on the ground for any more than like 30 seconds. And so it's only in space that we can see what happens, for instance, with fluid shifts, where the fluid goes, what that means for the health of the human. Fortunately, it appears that humans can do this. They can live, as far as we know. The longest time anyone's been in space is 14 months, and that was a Russian back in the 80s. But as far as we can tell, there's no showstopper for people living up there indefinitely, even.
And it'll be very interesting with this extended times in space, not only the acclimatizing to that environment, but then returning to the Earth and reacclimatizing to this one as well. And that is kind of that next question, is with you spending an extended amount of time in space. And of course, you know, with that discussion we just had, right now we're sending the fittest of the fit up to these environments. And you're starting to see with some of the private pay-to-play type things, but it's only a brief kind of suborbit type adventure. You know, you have folks that are, you know, heck, from Kentucky, William Shatner, just living down the road from us. But he goes up there, and we're seeing people now starting to get into that may not have the current healthcare pedigree that we're sending into the space program. And how does that evolve as we move forward and more people head to space? But, you know, specifically for you, with that time in space, kind of go through that, getting back down onto the Earth and getting that 1G that you have while we're sitting here on the planet, and kind of getting back to being in a normal gravitational environment, what we consider normal.
Yeah, it can be real debilitating. When you get into space, it's very hard to work and be efficient, but at least you can be mobile initially, and then you begin to adapt to your environment. On the ground, it's difficult even to be mobile. Some people can be kind of constrained, bedridden, if you will, simply because of the vertiginous feelings you get, the visual spatial mismatch, to where the world is just spinning around because your semicircular canals are readapting, your brain's rewiring to this gravity vector and saying, how does this relate to what my body's doing? And no, I'm not accelerating up every time I move my head or to the side. I'm back in a gravity field. I think it's remarkable that the brain can rewire itself in just a few days. But that, for me particularly, is an incredibly challenging thing. I can get up and I can walk in a straight line, but it is slow. It's a wide-based gait, and I can't turn unless except very slowly. So generally speaking, after a long duration space flight, humans have a really hard time getting up and moving around. Our blood pressure will come back. You know, we lose about 15% of total body water while we're up in space. That's a normal human adaptation to being in zero G. And then when you get back, all your blood falls down into your feet again, so you need to fill the tank. So we typically get a liter of fluid. But after that, after ingesting lots of fluids, we can get our cardiovascular state pretty much back to normal. The bone and muscle wasting that would occur in space if we didn't work out a lot, like 2.5 hours a day, we're mostly stiff, but we're able to get back to normal activities fairly quickly, back to the athletics that we enjoyed after a couple of months. Once our hematocrit and hemoglobin, which typically is reduced when you get home, normally that's back to normal. So even about 2 to 3 months here aerobically back to where you were pre-flight. But it's a huge stress on the body. It's hard to talk about how difficult it is to hit the ground or splash down like I did in the Dragon and just feel this huge magnet called Earth's gravity that is sucking you down into your seat, where everything is suddenly extremely heavy, even your lips feel heavy, and having to get through those first few hours and the first couple of days feeling that way.
That is, it's probably something that very few outside of the space industry actually even think of, is just the fact that, you know, that to us, what we're experiencing right now on Earth is normal, and then getting back to it and it being completely abnormal, with one G feeling completely different. I mean, as you mentioned, your lips even feeling heavy. And I just can't even imagine, you know, on a 2-year adventure to Mars, you know, one, landing on that planet after that amount of time in space, and then coming back, the how long it would take to re-acclimatize. And I guess that's, you know, much of the work of NASA is how to minimize, to maintain our physiology, to adapt once we arrive wherever we're arriving, and to minimize the long-term impact. And I mean, to me, that science is just incredibly fascinating in terms of what we can do, and then how do we apply that moving forward to medicine here on people that will always only experience 1G or something in that nature. So, you know, wrapping up today, you know, you can respond or any thoughts on that, but also any closing thoughts from you to emergency physicians and opportunities in the future for physicians outside the traditional realm of being in the four walls of an emergency department.
Yeah, sure. I'll kind of blend the two, and just to wrap up the prior conversation, essentially humans that fly in space, I think one could categorize them as having aged 10 to 20 years in the 6 months that they spend in space. We are, from a postural standpoint, we are neurologically extremely challenged. We would have osteoporosis, muscle wasting, such as, you know, a bedridden patient. Who knows? We don't know fully yet what the radiation impacts are. We get the equivalent of about 3 chest x-rays every day that we're in space and at the altitude in which we orbit. So all of these effects on the body do have their analog in patient populations on the ground. And so what NASA can do to figure that out, I think, helps patients and physicians around the world. I tell you, space medicine, for all your listeners out there, space medicine is just an incredibly fascinating field. Right now, access is still pretty limited. You know, we have a limited number of astronauts. Fortunately, there are these companies that are coming up and training people and flying them, both SpaceX and then Axiom, that is training their astronauts to fly. I was up there when a crew arrived on a Dragon crewed capsule that three astronauts that worked with Axiom were up there working with us. So the door is opening, getting wider and wider. So it's still very fascinating to look at, but still somewhat limited. And so I believe there are more venues opening up for people to train in space medicine. NASA could always use flight surgeons, new ones that are excited about working in the space program, and so are these companies that are coming up. They are all very interested in taking on flight surgeons and those who know how to take care of astronauts both before flight and in flight. So very exciting future. Every major advancement in transportation has started in this way, where wealthy people buy tickets to fly on these unique and wonderful, technically wonderful vehicles. And that opens the door for all of us to fly. So one day we're going to be able to buy a ticket and just fly in space. I'm almost sure that that's going to happen.
Well, talking with Dr. Thomas Marshburn, emergency physician and astronaut. You guys have a lot of work to do because apparently Facebook told me that George Jetson was born two days ago. And we've got a lot of ways to go for those floating cities to be out there. So, you know, good luck with all that. But more importantly right now, I appreciate the time that you've set aside for us. Thank you to NASA for helping make this opportunity available to us, because I think it's incredible information, incredible opportunities for emergency physicians, especially the future generation out there, to look at career opportunities in areas that you may not learn inside the classroom or during your residency, unless you're in one of those residencies that does focus on this, Ohio being a very common area for these type of aerospace medicine residencies. But I really appreciate your time. Good luck with everything. Look forward to hopefully talking with you down the road, and appreciate everything that you're doing.
Hey, thanks very much. And I'll just throw out Ohio and the University of Texas Medical Branch are the two places right now that folks could look into. But love talking to you, and hope to talk to you again in the future. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can find, he's not hard to find. You know, once you're an emergency physician and astronaut, you're all over the internet. And so UTMB, and then looking at the programs there in Ohio as well. Plenty of opportunities. Check those out, especially if you're interested in a combination of aerospace medicine, looking into some of these opportunities as an astronaut down the road. As for me, you can contact me at rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, at EverydayMed on Twitter. And we really appreciate everybody tuning in. Hopefully you've got the saved in your player so you can download every episode, because if not, you may miss great episodes, including astronauts. So until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.
If you're not on the front lines, you're on the sidelines.